Well, good evening. It's Martin North here from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this live show on the 9th of March 2021. Great to have you on board. And we're going to have a really interesting discussion this evening about property and property data and all the trends and what's going on. And we'll be able to see how the whole thing is going and, you know, what's going up, what's going on, what's going sideways. I have Louis ready to come, but just before I bring him in, let me just say what I always say. This is not financial advice. This is just general discussion. We don't know your individual circumstances, so please understand that. Also, do play nice in the chat room. No racial slurs, please. We will moderate the stream as required. This is as at the 9th of March 2021, if you're watching this in replay. If you'd like to get my attention and ask a question, use @WalkTheWorld to make sure that I see it in the chat. There's always a lot going on, but that's a really good way of making sure that you do get my attention and get your question asked. You can also use Super Chat. Two reasons. One is to make sure your question goes right at the top of the queue. The other is to make a contribution to help us with the ongoing running of the show. So without further ado, without further introductions, let me bring Louis Christopher in. Louis, hello, are you there?
Good day, Martin. Nice to be with you.
Hi, how are you going? Good to see you, and thank you very much for spending some of your Tuesday evening with us. Very excited to have you on. I often say to people that you are my go-to property analyst.
I think you're a pretty good analyst yourself, Martin. So.
Well, maybe, but you know, I have to say that over the years I've found you've got your finger on the pulse. And, you know, I think it would be really good for people to get a bit of a flavour of not just today, but the development of property data in Australia. Because, you know, you've been around in this sector for quite some time. You've seen a few changes, some good, some bad. And I think one of the things that I always highlight to people, Louis, is that, you know, there's a lot of data there, but it's not all of the same quality, is it?
Oh, no, there's very quality. There's a lot of sources nowadays compared to when I first got on the scene back in the year 2000. And I think it's very confusing for the average punter out there to work out what's actually going on in the market, particularly when it comes to auction clearance rates or just housing price movements. It can be quite difficult. There's lots of different sources. Some sources try to aim to be the most timely ever, but I think they lack in accuracy, while other sources, they're not so timely, but they try and have a more accurate type of indexing, I guess. Well, we stand, we are a data provider, we're kind of in the middle. But yeah, these days it's quite confusing. There was once upon a time though where perhaps the public were less confused, but it was coming from a very conflicted source, and that was the real estate institutes. But we wind ourselves all the way back to the 90s, and before then, the real estate institutes really dominated the property information space. The ABS was one source still back then, but their ultimate source of data came back to the real estate institutes. So the real estate institutes really, they were the last word. And as we know, a real estate institute represents real estate agents as their members. Now, that's not to say all real estate institutes come out and put out rubbish about the housing market, but there is an obvious potential conflict of interest with that type of model. And nowadays, of course, the real estate institutes do provide data in there. I've got to say, I think it's a little bit more balanced these days compared to what it used to be. But still, you've got to be watchful of everybody's conflict and all this. And that's not to say that just because someone has a potential conflict, that they are a bad apple, but you just got to be mindful of it.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's just worth reflecting on is this whole thorny question of real settlement data versus the sort of preliminary stuff that flies around, right? Because we know that many you know, agents will be putting information into the major portals on the way through a property transaction, but the settlement data itself doesn't land for a number of weeks or indeed a number of months.
That is absolutely spot on.
Yeah, and in fact, in some states, because of privatization, that settlement data is not publicly available.
Yes, that is correct, and can be very, very laggy indeed. Not just taking into account, when I speak of a lag, there's actually two fundamental reasons why we have data lag when it comes to settlement data, the data that comes from the Valuer General's office ultimately, and that is firstly the settlement period, so that the period between the exchange date and the settlement date, and Here in New South Wales, that period can be whatever the buy and seller determine, but I have an option that will be effectively 6 weeks. And then over above that, how long the VG actually hangs onto that data, try to clean that data before they give it to, say, data providers such as ourselves, or just provide it generally to the general public. And that could be another 2 to 3 weeks. But I'll give you one particular example where the data can be very, very laggy. That is off the plan development sales data. So a property, when it comes to off the plan developments, you may well put down, say, your 5% or your 10% deposit now for an off the plan. But that doesn't mean that property is actually settled now. And it will not be settled until the property has completed and you move in. Now, that could be 2 years away from now. And so as a data provider, we will not see that those off the plan sales come through the settlement system until 2 to 3 years after the price has been determined. That's a very, very long time indeed. And the key question, of course, is for data providers, how do they treat it when they put together, say, a median housing price index, or dare I say, a daily hedonic index, right? What do they do there? And that's a very critical question, and something that I'm very watchful of, put it that way.
Yeah, and, you know, the idea, of course, with the hedonics and other adjustment in engines is to try and take account of trends that you can't measure directly, but you are measuring them indirectly, right? So there is implicitly some sort of black box, some sort of assumptions underpinning the way that the data moves. And, you know, whether that's fully transparent or not depends on who you talk to and which index you're looking at. But the point is, it is not a straightforward science. You know, there's a lot of art to it. There's a lot of feel to it. I'll give you one example, Larry. When I moved out of Sydney, I exchanged contracts and completed 18 months later. Right? So that transaction would not have appeared anywhere for 18 months.
That's absolutely right. And then once it does come through, does the data provider provide it in the month that it's settled, or do they move it all the way back to the month you exchange where you actually agreed the price? Now, I would have thought a reasonable person would have thought, well, you put the record back into when price was agreed to. Because 18 months later, who knows what the market's done, right? But if you put it into the settlement period, you could really skew the output being, say, for example, the median house price.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll give you, you know, in the lending area, it's another example. There's a difference between a loan commitment and a loan drawdown, right? So all the ABS statistics is all about when loans are committed, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily always drawn down, and sometimes the drawdowns can be very much later. So again, there's lagginess between what people think's going on and what's actually going on. So, you know, I always say to people, be cautious, be careful, you know, don't assume just because it's there on a portal that it's accurate and right. You've got to actually ask a few more questions.
That's absolutely correct. But and for people who are interested in this, they will eventually get to the truth, and I would say most of your audience is well aware of these issues. But the real problem is, say, the average mum and dad who are not that particularly interested in it. They're just interested in maybe buying a house for the first time, or they're new to property investment, and they wouldn't be aware of any of these particular issues. They only just hear what the auction market did on Saturday, and you know that's their only source of information, which is concerning. But you know that's life, isn't it?
It is life. And one last question with regard to the data. PEXA, of course, has now started to also provide some information. And of course, that's the electronic settlement system, effectively. Are you seeing that shaping or changing the data landscape much at the moment?
It will be interesting to see where PEXA takes us. I think that they are showing more and more of an interest in the market, and I think where ultimately they will go is they may well provide additional indexes out there. I suspect that one of their goals is to be an authority in terms of what the housing market is doing. They're certainly very big, very influential, and I'm sure that they will become more and more on the public stage.
I'm sure that's true. They've already published a couple of reports, and I know they're going to be publishing more ahead. Taffy said, smoke and mirrors. Well, there may be some smoke and mirrors. The trouble is, it's hard to know what smoke, what mirrors, and what's real, right? So that's why
It is challenging. I mean, look, we try and put indexes which are together, which are more timely, but we do limit those. So as you would be well aware, we put together an asking prices series, which is timely, doesn't need to be revised, but still not foolproof. So the issue being with an asking prices index series is, hey, not every advertisement has an asking price in it, particularly for, say, auctions. Mind you, auctions still represent a relatively small section of the overall market. But nevertheless, that's one of the flaws of an asking price index. You're not going to capture those properties which do not advertise an asking price. And I think people just need to be aware that every index out there, it's hard to get a foolproof, perfect index in property. And the fundamental reason behind that is because ultimately every property out there is unique. Even two apartments right next to each other, one apartment might well have been painted very weirdly. The other apartment's got a great view. So every property is unique, and that's the issue. Unlike, say, the stock market, where you've got standardized stocks, BHP shares. One BHP share is effectively the same as the next, except, of course, say, preference shares, but they're clearly marked out. This is the issue with property, and we'll always be grappling with this. And I think what's important for data providers such as ourselves is, okay, be upfront about the weaknesses, have a methodology that's out there so people can read and understand the methodology, so they understand what's included, what's not included. I think if you do that and you come to the industry and you come to the public with, you know, the right mindset that you wish to be trying to improve the well-being of everybody out there, of the community, in terms of understanding what's going on in the market, then that's the place to be. But sadly, I wouldn't say every provider is necessarily like it.
Absolutely. I must just share this one with you, Lou. This is from Edwin, right? Hold on. Where's Louis, right? False advertising, you said, Louis, not Joy's older brother. Referring, I assume, to the to the beard. Edwin, yeah. What are you saying?
It can be a long life, and somebody tell me a beard looks good on me, and I get to save some time in the morning.
Excellent. Now, let me just touch on SQM itself a little bit, because I actually had a quick look at the site earlier on today, and you do a lot more than just property data now. I hadn't realised that.
Yeah. We this doesn't get a lot of publicity at all, but we actually cover a lot of the funds management industry. So we actually have data on about 10,000 different funds. If you've ever heard of a company called, say, Lonsec or Zenith, Morningstar, no doubt you would have heard of Morningstar. We actually compete with them on the ratings front. So we issue ratings on managed funds. And we've got to be very careful how we put that out there, because we actually do that under our asset license. And so that type of information or that advice is actually only for financial advisors. So we're very cautious about not putting that up on, say, Twitter or anything like that. So we do that. And then, of course, we've got equities data, which I'm actually very keen to build out. So we've actually built up there on the site an equity screen where you can screen stocks on, say, earnings multiples, earnings growth, basically smoothing day averages. So a lot of technical analysis is there as well. We've effectively built out an investment data business. Some people who do not know us or come across us the first time seem to think, oh, well, they just cover property. They must be property spruikers, and that's that. But we're not. We don't make our money through selling real estate. Property developers and real estate agents represent a very small, minuscule amount of our revenue base. They just basically pick up our data. We've diversified the business as well over time into managed funds and, as mentioned, equities, and we wish to continue to do that.
Yeah, very interesting. And I guess as you sort of build out those services, you know, you begin to see some cross currents and cross correlations between the different domains of information as well.
You're doing it as well as the usage. So what we're finding, of course, is that financial advisors, which I've got to say over recent years, that whole sector's been consolidating in a big way, and that's a nice way to put on it. We've seen advisors increasingly need property data for a whole bunch of reasons. I think they can see that, look, you know, if they wish to provide a proper good information source for their own shop, they need to know something about property as well. And of course, advisors, many of them, of course, have clients who are involved in self-managed super funds. And many of our self-managed super funds out there do own a property. We're definitely been seeing that over time, that there has been more and more demand from financial advisors for property data.
Well, very, very interesting. But let's sort of switch the focus more closely onto the property sector, because obviously, you know, there's a lot of interesting cross-currents within the property sector at the moment. And I guess I'd be interested to get your read on what you're seeing. You know, what are the critical trends that you're seeing at the moment in terms of, let's maybe start with the auctions and then we'll go on to the listings and some other things. The auctions numbers are quite interesting, aren't they? Not as advertised on some other portals.
Absolutely. So we've just put out our auction numbers for the last week. For Melbourne, we actually recorded an auction clearance rate of just below 50%. It came in 49.7, if I recall. And then Sydney came in at about 69%, which, if I recall, over the weekend, I saw once again Domain's numbers and REA's numbers being touted being in the high 80s. But that's just not happening. The market is not that strong. We're not disputing the fact the market isn't strong. I think the market is quite strong, particularly in the Sydney market and the outer rings of Sydney. But to suggest it's running in the high 80s, that would suggest that prices are rising, you know, near 20%, 25% per annum. We don't think they're running that hard overall. I wouldn't be surprised if they're running at a tempo of somewhere about 10 to 12% right now, which is still quite strong in what's supposed to be a low inflationary environment. But nevertheless, we're recording lower auction clearance rates than our peers. By way of background, a number of your audience will be well aware. I used to run a company, and then before that, be the head of research called Australian Property Monitors. And in the early noughties, they used to be the sole provider of auction clearance rates. And I was actually responsible for the team to collect all the auction results. And I think we went over this in our last catch-up in terms of how auction data was collected and the motivation behind putting our own auction clearance rates together. But since then, we've been getting more and more interest, which is fantastic. But I got to say, the media still hung on to reporting and publishing that most timely result that comes out, say, Saturday night, because it's out there. And I don't think we'll be able to defeat that somehow. I think Nine will always publish the Domain auction results because they own Domain. And then News Limited will generally publish the REA results because they've got an interest there. And I got to say, actually, the REA results are even worse than Domain's. They're missing far. If you actually look at the auction counts they publish, they only represent about a third of the activity that's out there.
Yeah, and that is really the point, isn't it? That they, you know, throw this data out there. It's picked up in their media outlets because, of course, that strong relationship between the data and the media owners, and then they try and sort of spin it and spruik it. But the fact is that they've got some vested interests, and so you've got to be a little bit cautious about why they're doing what they're doing and the numbers they're doing and the methods that they use, which means that quite often the numbers are just way overstated compared with reality.
Well, spot on. I mean, if you're only reporting your clearance rate of what has been reported in, I mean, the moment an agent doesn't want to report in a result because it didn't go their way, you've got immediately a skewed result. And that's been an issue ever since I've been in this game. How we used to deal with that issue when I was back at Australian Property Monitors was that we would send our university students out to the auctions and get the result anyway off those agents who didn't want to report into us. And so we would get a reported rate of above 90% on the day. Now, let me tell you, Martin, that was very, very costly exercise. And this takes us all the way back to the rivers of gold, which, of course, have all gone. So there's not much of a budget to undertake that type of exercise. So the best we can do as a organisation is to provide something out there which is perhaps a little bit less timely, but is far more accurate. It is what it is, I guess.
Well, no, it comes out, typically on a Tuesday, and I think it gives you a really good read, not least because it shows you what happened before as well as on the auction date and after the auction date, which, of course, is the real world, isn't it?
Spot on. And I think many people need to be aware, too, that look, a number of these records that are going into domain and REAs are based on auctions that may well have happened actually weeks ago. We've seen private treaties being suddenly classified as auctions. You know, it's not good. But like I said, it is what it is. We're trying to make inroads in terms of getting people to be more aware of the issues. And I'm glad to say, for example, mastheads such as the AFR, they will occasionally run without clearance rates. So I know the journos there, they're pretty professional overall, and that they are aware of the issues and definitely sympathise with the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's interesting because I've had a few chats with some of the journos on a few of the rags, and some of them are beginning to understand that there's a slightly more complicated story. But, of course, they tend to sort of jump for the simple, straightforward headline, right? That's the nature of the beast.
That's the nature of the beast. They don't have a lot of time to investigate, unfortunately. They've got to pump out 6 or 7 stories each and every day.
Absolutely. It's interesting. Edwin just made a comment here, which I'll just throw up because it's quite interesting. Wait till REA and Domain run their own real estate agencies. No real live data will be reported other than the narrative they want to push on the day. Oh, Edwin, what are you saying?
I know. Edwin's definitely got a very convicted view here that, you know, he believes that the Domain and REA one of these days will effectively become real estate agents themselves, from my understanding. That's his view. Or they want to become that way as a way to continue their revenue growth. And we'll wait and see what happens. That may well play out. Not sure yet, but I'm definitely well aware of very large real estate agency groups who are now just trying a few things to reduce the power and influence of REA and Domain. For example, putting up their own listings before they put it up on their own website, before they put it up on REA and Domain. We're talking like a number of days before they do it. They put up an REA and Domain. So there is this ongoing pushback, but I'm not so sure it's enough to really conquer REA and Domain at this stage.
Yeah, no, very interesting. It is, an interesting evolution of the industry, and I think we're going to see some further changes because, of course, the volumes are still relatively low, and that's the other thing that, you know, you highlight through your analysis. Compared with last year and the year before, the transaction volumes really aren't that much higher.
When it comes to the auction volumes, look, I think maybe we should bring up a chart just to see if we can get an idea of the volume. So
yeah, it'd be great.
Just bear with me one moment. I'm going to share a screen. Okay. Okay, it won't be long. I'm just going to take you back. This is our media site, and I'll just take you back to the auction results. Okay, now, can you see that chart below there? Okay, so this is our auction clearance rate. So our charts on the line represents, of course, a clearance rate, and the bar lines represent the total number of our properties scheduled for auction. It gives you a good idea of volume.
Right.
And as you can see here, we go back here, back to this time last year, there was an absolute collapse in volume. We know why. We had lockdowns and literally the market froze right up.
Yes.
And then volume picked up. Now, where we are compared to this time last year is, of course, we've had the opening of the property season, and we've had basically volumes coming through in Sydney in effectively sort of the 800 to 900s each and every week, which is actually lower than what we had for the opening this time last year, just a little bit lower. But I suspect as we get into the next few weeks, volumes will easily surpass what we'll have for this time last year, given the collapse in volumes that we had throughout the course of April. And for Melbourne, it's a similar situation, I think. Here we go. Here's a Melbourne chart. Actually, you've got to say the volumes have been, there's a couple of weeks there which have been relatively high compared to this time last year. But you notice the periods, of course, during the lockdown where there was just zero volume. So I think given over the course of the year, if you consider the course of the last 12 months, volume would be down on, say, previous years. But for now, it looks like we're getting middle-of-the-road volumes. You might have a different view there, Mark.
No, I tend to agree. And if you go back over the last two or three years, so I would go back to 2017, because 2017 was the hot year, right? So that's when prices really reached their peaks. If you compare the volumes of transaction then and now, we're still significantly below that much higher level back then, right?
And that's true.
And that's true in terms of lending growth, and it's true in terms of volume of transactions, and it's true also in the number of auctions cleared. Not necessarily the percentage, because there were higher listings, but the percentage cleared. You know, it's the number.
Interesting point you mentioned 2017. That's when the market did peak following the restrictions on lending. I've noticed of late there's been some stories that came out last week and the week prior where it said, like, you know, the market's running the hottest it's ever been for the last 17 years. Now, that's just simply not true, in my view. They're basing that on these crazy auction clearance rates. And, of course, a CoreLogic daily index coming up for the first few weeks in the year. But the truth is that I think the second half of 2016 was when the market was its hottest that I've ever seen throughout the course of my career. If I recall, dwelling prices in Sydney rose by about 8% in one quarter.
Yep.
At that time. So that was when the market was at its hottest. I would have to call this probably the third or second hottest market, and it all depends on which city we're talking about as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting then, of course, because that was before the tightening of credit started, right? So that was when basically if you had a pulse, you could get a mortgage and you'd get a big mortgage, right? So credit was really strong, and that was before the Royal Commission. That was before the tightening on the investment lending and the interest-only loans, all those things. So there is a very strong correlation between credit growth and home prices, and in fact, there's a very, you know, there's a analysis I've done to show that's always the truth. And if you think today, the net credit growth is still bumping along. It's a lot lower than it was back in 2016-17. It's a bit stronger than it was. But the other interesting factor there is that the number of people who are also paying down their loans now and reducing their mortgage footprint is very different from when it was back in 2016. So I agree with you. I don't think that we can claim that this is the hottest market in 20 years or something as reported. That's just way, way too simplistic.
It is. And as mentioned, it just depends on which city we're actually discussing. Certainly, if you look at Melbourne, Melbourne's not running hot in my view. Prices may well be rising, and perhaps it may well be rising a little bit more when we discuss, say, outer Melbourne freestanding houses. But overall, Melbourne's far from running hot overall.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And in fact, what I find fascinating is, you know, I tend to look at units and houses separately because there are very different stories there. And I think it's quite important actually to split the two out as far as possible, because high-rise units in Sydney, nowhere. You know, the volumes are way down, the prices are way down, the interest is way down, and frankly, we're seeing more people potentially trying to list to get out, whereas houses, a bit different. Now, I know that you do look at some dimensionality between units and houses, but there's also some where you block it together.
This is true. So I think you're referring to our rental data in particular. And what we might do here is we might do another share screen where I'll jump into some of the rental statistics we are seeing. So just bear with me one moment. Okay, great. Okay, hopefully you can see that. So what I've put up here is one of our more newer indexes, which is a weekly rent listings. Everyone's well aware of our monthly vacancy rate series. But we came out last year with a new series just looking at the listings themselves, not filtering them out, not doing anything like that, just looking at the weekly rental listings. And so it's a little bit more of a timely series on the rental market, I guess. And the chart I'm showing here is actually Postcode 2000, which is city CBD. And you can see quite clearly, and this is shown by days of market. I'm going to move it over to houses and units. It's probably an easier chart to read, of the light blue representing all units. And as you would expect in Postcode 2000, there's not really any houses in the city at all. You can see the surge in listings that we had when COVID broke out. We were looking at listings, weekly rental listings, roughly running at about 400, and that jumped up to 1200. So three times the normal amount hit the city CBD unit market. And that caused a massive surge in rental vacancy rates and a subsequent massive decline in rents. So we'll just bring up the rental series here. And you can see here the drop in rents. So for a standard two-bedroom unit, that would command somewhere just under $1,000 a week pre-COVID, and rents effectively fell down to just on about $700 a week. $300 a week would take off rents in Sydney. Now, there's been a bounce back. So, Martin, you may recall when we were together with Edwin last time, I did mention to you we're starting to see a little bit of a trickle back into the CBD of Sydney, and that's continued on. And so we've seen a little bit of a bounce in the rents. They've come off the canvas. But the question is, will I go back to pre-COVID levels? I suspect they won't. I don't think we're going to see a full reversal of the surplus rental stock in the city CBD. Now, that's the city CBD. Let's bring up the Melbourne CBD, because that's really been the epicenter of this downturn, in my view. Once again, you can see the falls are actually far more pronounced. And indeed, we're showing for units now down 34% in rents for Postcode 3000 over the last 12 months, which is huge. So rents are now lower than where they were over 10 years ago in Melbourne.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I may have mentioned before, mortgage stress for property investors in 3000 in Melbourne is the highest anywhere.
Yes, so no, it would not be a good time to be a Melbourne property investor. And I'd just like to point out too that unlike Sydney, where we're seeing this reversal now, we're starting to see a trickle back of people coming into the city CBD. We're not seeing it yet in Melbourne. As we can see here, really, listings are still hovering at very, very elevated levels, and there's a lot more new for rent listings coming into the marketplace, holding those levels up. So I'm not seeing a lot of relief coming through at this point in time. Now, the contrast to this is other regions, and I'd just like to point out to your audience one region I'm always following to see what's going on, and that is the Blue Mountains in Sydney. Because this was a region where I first noticed a massive change in listings. And you can see that, just prior to COVID, it was pretty high, somewhere around 220, 230 weekly rental listings coming through, and that fell all the way down to below 100. It's come up a little bit going into Christmas, so I think that's a sort of fairly normal trend, but it's come off again the last couple of weeks. The vacancy rate, as we've got for the Blue Mountains, is very, very low. The lowest we've got on our numbers back to 2005, just running at 0.8%. And what has that meant for rents? Not too much, a bit of a pickup in units, but certainly quite a contrast compared to, say, in the CBD, where there's been a big fall. I can point out other regions where we're seeing a more accelerated rental increases in the Blue Mountains. But yeah, interesting, and a bit of a contrast.
Absolutely. Can we just briefly look at Perth? Because I think people are claiming that the Perth market has gone mad. again, my data is not as definitive as some of the other views that I've heard as to what's going on. True, there are some pockets where there is actually some quite good movements up, but there's also quite a lot of areas where there's still a lot of struggle. And in fact, I did some analysis the other day for Rockingham and places like that, which is south of Perth on the coast. And there, prices are still way down from where they were in 2013, right, for units and houses. And the listings numbers have come down a little, but there's still a lot of stuff going on. Have you got a perspective on what's really going on in Perth and surrounding areas?
Yeah, well, maybe I might do it through our charts.
Yeah, do. Mind. Absolutely. Sure.
So once again, I'm going to share the screen. Okay, so the first chart I've got on Perth here is weekly asking rents. And you can see here, firstly, the downturn that occurred in the city starting effectively from mid-2013, where rents were at one stage for a house was about $625 a week, and it bottomed out at somewhere around $1,415 a week. But since then, we've seen a pickup in rents, and they're back up to, for a house, about $500 a week and about, you know, $380 a week for units. And it's showing up in our table here for the 12-month change that rents for houses have risen by 12%. This, of course, is asking rents, just to make that point. And units are up by 11%. So that's a big change in rents. Of course, nowhere near where we were at the 2013 high, but you can see the direction. You know, and if you were, if you're involved in technical analysis, you would have to say the trend is your friend here, right? So when we consider basically vacancy rates for Perth, well, that tells a story as well, doesn't it?
Mm.
Yeah, it's come right back down, very tight conditions. Our view is that while this has not yet fed into the median house price data yet, it soon will. We've generally found that the rental market in Perth leads the overall housing market, both going up and going down. So our expectation is that this year, Perth will experience a pickup in prices. We think the northern end of Perth is where a lot of the action is going to be, near the coastline, near the Joondalup Railway. And yeah, you're right, man. Like, the median house price is still lower than where it was back in 2008. The flip side of that, though, is I've got to say that I think Perth's offering some pretty good value compared to a lot of the other cities around Australia.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, thanks for that. And it is fascinating to, you know, get some granularity again in the data, because what I find quite often is, again, you know, these, you know, generic sort of statements about what's going on. But I would highlight that the outer suburban areas of Perth, north and south along the coast, are not behaving precisely the same way as close into Perth, right? And if you look at the prices, I mean, Mandurah is the one I... Unfortunately, I picked on Mandurah 3 or 4 years ago as the highest mortgage stress postcode in the country, right? And so I keep going back to...
Mandurah has always had issues because it's an area where the developers, for whatever reason, have really focused in on for a long time now. So it's the moment there's any sort of increase in demand, the developers just jump in like crazy and build very quickly. So, yeah, Mandurah would not be an area where I would consider investing in over the medium or long term, just calling it straight.
Edwin, just before he left, said, Martin, you read wrong, mate. Perth market has not gone mad. The people in Perth are mad. Well, we've got Tony LeCounter on next week, so we'll discuss that in more detail then, because Tony is actually hails from Perth. But interesting observation, Edwin. Thank you for that. And I think Edwin's about to disappear. And Aaron said, bring back the Mandurah drive-through. I did a show some time ago. I don't know whether you saw it, Louis, but we actually got somebody to drive around Mandurah. And every time when we drove around down the street, where we saw a for sale sign, we actually sounded a bell, right? And so we went ding, 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 ding. And it really made the point about just how much was on the market.
You must have picked up a lot of local fans there.
Well, we actually had some very interesting reactions. We had a few politicians who actually hated us, including some federal members. But some of the local politicians thought we were actually doing them a service because they've been saying it for a long time and nobody was really taking them seriously. So, you know, it's pretty interesting. Now, if we sort of stand back a little bit, and you know, we're clearly a bit of an inflection point at the moment. There was an announcement today, and I'll just put this one up. This was actually the statement from Morrison, plans, recovery phase, migration, critical. And basically the story was he's going to open the taps and bring migrants back in. Now, you actually shared that and you expressed an opinion about it. So I'd like to get your take on it, Louis, please.
Yes, well, we've had a view for some time, and I've had a little bit of a mini debate about it on Twitter. I think there's some that just can't believe this could possibly happen, that the federal government will use migration as a policy lever to try and accelerate economic growth, but also perhaps absorb some of the surplus stock that's in the housing market. I'm not at all surprised to hear federal government flag this today, that you know they're looking to potentially adjust migration because they are concerned about a skills shortage. And you know, you've got to wonder, well, where are the skill shortages? I didn't realize fruit picking was a real issue on skill there, but you know, hey, I'm not going to make any judgment. It's seems like as though it's going to come through, and I suspect what we'll see here is that the moment the international border is open, the government will do all it can to entice and ramp up migration. Keeping in mind, before COVID, we were getting circa net international migration of about 200,000 people. As we know, last year the borders closed, so that number for last year would have fallen to near zero. And indeed, the budget estimates were that for 2021 that we could actually see a net outflow of people out of Australia. Now, no doubt that would have been very concerning for the government, because I think the government is sort of reliant on migration population growth for one of these things. For one reason, it definitely helps the budget in many respects. So it helps the here and now, and it certainly helps the property industry. The fact that we've had zero migration, yet last year we believe we built some 170,000 dwellings, means that there is a surplus there, and I think many are looking for migration or a bigger Australia to help soak up that surplus stock.
Absolutely. Well, it's not surprising, particularly the high-rise stock, because you know there are thousands and thousands and thousands of vacant high-rise properties, more being built, some of those by the big developers, some of those also from individual property investors who bought them over the last few years and are really struggling to sell them at the moment. Prices are on average down, in some cases, 20% from where they were 2 or 3 years ago, and they still can't shift them. Plus, of course, they've got the issues to do with the structural cracks and also the flammable cladding, and so people are trying to get out and you know trying to avoid having to cough up the 40,000 or whatever it is to deal with it. So my theory is that some of that migration could well be trying to sort of flood those areas where you've got all of this vacant property to try and actually save the high-rise developers. I suspect also that it will spill over into other areas too. And, you know, I don't know precisely, you know, which part of Sydney you're located in, but I drive around Sydney quite a lot. It's too much traffic already. We don't really want much more, in my view. It's too crowded already.
It is crowded. Certainly over the last few weeks, as more and more people have gone back into working out of the office, the trains are now full COVID capacity. I can tell you that I take a train from time to time into work, and they're running pretty much full COVID capacity. So I don't know what it's going to be like in another few more weeks. They may well have to ease restrictions further in terms of allowing people to sit next to each other on the train. But yeah, you're right, Martin, in the sense that I agree that, number one, migration historically has tended to come through to the Sydney and Melbourne CBD or inner city locations first. That's generally where the first stop is for many people who come to migrate to Australia. And then you do see a bit of a trickle-on effect to other regions around Australia. But Sydney and Melbourne CBD or the inner city area is generally where you see a large number of migrants come first.
And yeah.
There's no doubt a lot of developers would be feeling the pinch right now. And of course, there's a number of developers who are large donators to the various political parties.
Absolutely. I also know from my SME surveys, there are a lot of businesses operating in and around the CBDs that are really hurting because they haven't had the traffic for a long time and they're just not getting any significant improvement at the moment. So you can also see the knock-on effects if they actually get more people back into those urban areas. That can flow on into, you know, retail and hospitality in those areas too. So you can sort of understand the logic. But
And I certainly don't begrudge any small business that owns a shop in the inner city area. I mean, we all want to see them do well. No one likes to see their small businesses suffer. In all this, but you know, there are other questions that need to be addressed, isn't it?
Well, it is, and you know, my general perspective is that the JobKeeper programs wasn't targeted enough at small end of town. It was all went to the big end of town. A lot of those actually make super profits as a result of it, and we've still got a lot of small businesses who are really very much up against it.
Yes, indeed. Yep, I do agree that there is still an issue regarding the potential for a lot of small business insolvency. We've had a moratorium, which has helped the sector. That moratorium, if I recall, is just about to come to an end or has just ended.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to switch the conversation to Brisbane a little bit, if we could, because, again, people keep saying to me, oh, Brisbane's really hot. You know, the market is nothing like Sydney and Melbourne. It's been hot all the way through. It's hot now, and it's going to be hot ahead. What's your data telling us about Brisbane? It'd be interesting to see if you can share a few charts there.
Yeah, let's do that. I think overall our impression of Brisbane is that it's not running hot right now, but we are noticing some dwelling price increases in the middle and outer rings once again for freestanding homes. So we're seeing a bit of strength there.
Right.
But once again, the closer you get to the city, the CBD location, generally speaking, the weaker it is. And let's bring out some charts once again on this point.
And I had a couple of people say, could you make the chart slightly bigger? I don't know whether you can zoom your screen a little bit. I can't do anything at this end. But
bigger. Okay.
If you can just maybe make the chart a bit bigger, that would help people whose screens are small.
Okay, let's see what we can do on that front. Oh, you're asking. This might be a bit challenging on my computer here. I'm just still getting used to my
Okay. Computers. Well, if you can't, don't worry. But I thought I'd just ask, seeing as I had a few people on the chat ask.
Okay. Very cool. All right. Let's bring up Brisbane. And maybe what we'll do at least is discuss the numbers in a little bit more detail.
Mm.
So firstly, the vacancy rates of Brisbane. Throughout the course of 2020, we initially did see a surge in vacancies, but then that quickly dissipated. And the trend overall for 2020 and going into 2021 is that vacancies have been falling. And then you need to consider part of the greater trend. It just seems to be part of this greater trend that we've been seeing since 2017, where vacancy rates peaked at 4% but have been slowly falling since then. Now, before that, of course, we had this period from 2013 through to 2017 where vacancies were just on the march. And this is the time of pretty strong development, particularly in the inner city Brisbane areas there. We had very high rental vacancy rates around South Bank and in the CBD itself. But eventually that stock was absorbed and the trend has been down. Now I'm just going to jump on asking sale prices for Brisbane. And so this covers off the pink lines for the unit market, and the blue lines represent the all houses and three bedroom houses. And look, when you look at this chart, I wouldn't say it's the most exciting chart I've ever seen. unit market really hasn't done that much in the last 6 to 7 years. It's been a little bit of a pickup, but it's not like as though it's doubled every 7 years, right? That hasn't happened. We can look at, say, the 10-year trend for houses and on our numbers. Dwelling prices have risen on average by about 2.3% per annum. So there hasn't been a lot of activity there. Now, when I consider some of the leading indicators for activity for Brisbane, I like to look at overall listings. What are listings doing? So this is the for sale listings. I like to split it between houses and units, because I'm just hearing people saying the chart's a little bit too small. So this chart here, the light blue represents units and the darker blue represents houses. And generally speaking, what I've seen in an accelerating market is a downturn in listings. You start to see listings fall because absorption rates increase. Now, for Brisbane, probably the last few months, we're starting to see a little bit of a downtrend in listings occur. So that's interesting. And it is getting to the point where listings are now lower than what they were for probably about the last 6 or 7 years now. So there is a bit of a downtrend occurring. We haven't really seen a major acceleration yet, but I've got to say, I think we will see some price gains this year for the Brisbane market. It's not the market which I regard as being the most fair indeed or offering the biggest bargains. I still think that would be Perth. But nevertheless, it's there. It's a city. It's nowhere near as overvalued as, say, Sydney or Melbourne.
Yeah, very interesting. And that's really the point. You know, I've looked at the long-term trends in terms of prices in and around Brisbane. The growth has been very slow for quite a few years. And if you go out to some of the further areas beyond Brisbane, in fact, the growth is negative rather than positive. So it's a very different market. We haven't seen that huge boom like we had in Sydney and Melbourne from 15, 16, 17 onwards.
Yes, I would agree with that. The last boom that occurred in Brisbane actually occurred over the years 2004 through to about 2007. And over that time, we were getting dwelling price increases of between 15 to 25% per annum. It's a very strong time. But eventually, two things happened. We had rate rises, which definitely affected the market. The market became very overvalued, and the developers came to town, and they built in a very accelerated fashion. So, that was the last boom. So arguably, you could say, based just simply on timing, Brisbane is due to actually have a bit of an acceleration in the market. But we just, I wouldn't hold my hat too much on the stock and market numbers yet. I'd like to see them fall further. But nevertheless, I think we'll see some price gains this year.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, while you've got your charts up, let me just ask you to go to Adelaide, because I always get the complaint, nobody ever talks about Adelaide. So we're going to talk about Adelaide just briefly.
No problem. Okay, so what I'll do is I'll bring us up my houses and units once again. So this is the same chart, but once again for Adelaide on total property and listings. And you'll note here that we are seeing a bit of a downtrend now occurring, a more sustained downtrend, which happened right throughout the course of 2020, where listings have been falling. And they're actually at levels now which that's the lowest we've actually recorded since 2010. So this would be a sign potentially of a market picking up. Let's have a look at the asking sale prices for Adelaide to see if vendors are becoming more confident. And look, not much of course has occurred over the period, say 2010 through to about 2020, really. It's been sort of fairly slow, no major downturn, no major upturn. Like Brisbane, the last major boom in Adelaide occurred between the years, if I recall, 2004 through to 2008. It's been relatively quiet since then. One thing, though, that I will like to point out is the rental vacancy market. So this chart is on vacancy rates. And hopefully, despite its size, you can see the trend at least, and the trend is that rental vacancy rates have been falling They initially picked up a little bit on the outbreak of COVID, but then started to fall away again from mid-2020 to a point now where they're about the same low, some of the low levels that we achieved in, say, 2008 and 2006. And as a result, I think we're going to see a bit of a rise in the rents. Yes, we are. The last 12 months, rents for houses have risen by 5% and for units up 4.3%.
And, you know, one of the things I like about the, your charts, Louis, is the way that you can see the connectivity between the different types of data, right? You begin to realize that it is actually all quite logical.
Yeah, that's what I believe. That's what we attempt to do. I mean, obviously, the data is a data, and it's sort of manipulated to make it the way.
No.
It just is what it is. But I remember once upon a time, I spoke to a sort of very well-known economist who, before I put together the vacancy rate series, said to me, oh, look, there just doesn't seem to be any correlation between vacancy rates and rents. And I said, well, where are you getting your vacancy rates from? And he said, well, the Real Estate Institute. I said, well, I'm not going to say any more. But there is a relationship. We've seen it. It's coming through our vacancy rates. Whenever we see a tightening of vacancy rates, we generally see a rise in rents. Now, I'd like to point out one more thing for Adelaide, if you don't mind. And let's bring this up. And that is the Adelaide CBD, which is postcode 5000. Okay.
Wow.
Like Sydney, like Melbourne, like Brisbane, we had a surge in vacancy rates for the CBD location. It got to over 8.5% for the Adelaide CBD. It has come back now down to 6.3%, still above average. People have been moving or being more interested in the outer rings of Adelaide. That's what we can see. So I'm pretty sure I've got a region called Adelaide Hills, Northern Adelaide. Okay, and you can see the chart here. Very clear. We've got our vacancy rates in that area of below 0.5%. And let's have a look at the rents. And yeah, rents have picked up for houses by 5.2% over the last 12 months. And there has been a bit of a pickup that you can see there. So Adelaide's probably showing some similarities between Sydney and Melbourne in the sense of weaker in the city areas and stronger in the outer regional areas.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Somebody's just said you're losing viewers the more longer you talk about Adelaide, Martin. Hugh, come on. We've got.
We cannot please everybody.
I have to say that always is the problem, right? You cannot please all of the people all of the time, I can tell you, on this game. And that's very interesting. Thank you for that. Let me then turn the conversation slightly, because you do a series of sort of scenarios based on, you know, where things are and where things might be playing to. And, you know, I don't know where you are in that cycle of scenario builds, but I'd love to pick your brains on how you think this could play out and what scenarios might or might not play. I mean, we're in the situation where we know that bond rates are rising, and there is now talk for the first time that interest rates might go up sooner than people perhaps expected. We've got the issue of migration. We've got the JobKeeper, JobSeeker ending. We've got the chance of the Treasurer doing a few sort of spot fixes for tourism and a few things. We've got the vaccine rollout, which is some months, you know, in train. And we've got an unlock at some point, but we're not sure when, right, in terms of the international borders. How do you put all of that into a series of logical, sensible scenarios and come up with a sense of, well, it could be like this or it could be like that? Because that's what I do, and I find it pretty darn hard.
Well, let's bring up the scenario table. Hopefully I can make it big enough that your audience can see. Can you see that, Martin? Hopefully everyone can see that as well. So, each year we come out usually in late October, early November, this time around, we want to give ourselves as much time as possible. So we put it out in the beginning of December for our dwelling price forecast for the year ahead.
Mm.
And once upon a time, this used to be, you know, I used to be pretty good at doing this, Martin, because all I had to be concerned about was what interest rates were going to do, or make a forecast for interest rates, what population was going to do, and what the exchange rate was going to do, and then look at each local city in terms of what was going on locally. Nowadays, I have to be a COVID expert, and I also have to sort of, you know, sort of try and get into the mind of the APRA chairman, as well as many other minds who have a lot of influence upon our housing market. And so the job has become more challenging, there's no question about it. Nevertheless, with that disclaimer in mind, our scenario, our base case scenario we had for 2021 was that dwelling prices would rise between 5 to 9%. As you can see in the table here, we were most bullish on the Perth housing market, and we've covered that earlier tonight. And then we were reasonably bullish on the Sydney market in the sense that we thought Sydney would have a recovery. The assumptions behind that were that the cash rate would remain unchanged at 0.1%, that QE would expand, and that's now come true. We all know that that's the RBA has thrown another $100 billion at the 3 year and the cash rate, not the cash rate, just the mainly at the 3 year, that there would be a third outbreak or a COVID wave, and this occurred before Sydney went into part lockdown. So we put this out before that outbreak occurred in the Northern Beaches. The job people would be extended to September quarter 2021. That doesn't look like that's going to play out. And there would be a progressive rollout of the COVID vaccine. So when I look at this base case scenario now, I have to say, look, it doesn't look like it's going to come in because we know JobKeeper is not going to be extended. Yes, the government has flagged that perhaps there will be some relief for the tourism and hospitality trade. We wait to see exactly what that is. But overall, JobKeeper is not going to be extended. I think the scenario which potentially is playing out a little bit more likely right now is our scenario three. And that is that we say a better than expected rollout of the vaccine in the first half of the year, maybe. A bounce in employment, we have had a bit of a bounce. No more lockdowns in terms of the fact that the state borders remain open. Regional hub does open up, so that's to New Zealand and Singapore. So look, we've had a couple of lockdowns very early in the year, but I don't think that's been enough to affect this. I'm talking about a larger lockdown. JobKeeper phased out as planned, which is looking like that's going to occur, and QE scaled back after mid-year. So in other words, QE was going to be with us until at least June. And I'd have to say potentially this is a scenario that's looking more likely to play out. You would have to say the conditions are looking a little bit more rosier at this point in time, notwithstanding the blight and long end of the yield curve. And under that scenario, once again, Perth is our pick, where we actually think dwelling prices could rise between 10 to 15%. Sydney, we've got it down to 3 to 7%. So we think, and Melbourne, we're suggesting potentially almost a flat market. And the reason why we came up with that was that we feel that Sydney and Melbourne are our two cities which I think rely on JobKeeper the most in many respects. And we know, of course, Melbourne's been hit pretty hard in its small business community, to a lesser extent Sydney. And we also know that, okay, JobKeeper will only be extended to the tourism and hospitality sector, which Sydney and Melbourne is not really big on. You'd have to say Brisbane or Queensland. That's a pretty big economy for hospitality and tourism. There's still, of course, hospitality and tourism sector in Sydney and Melbourne. But I would have to say a lot of smaller businesses are more reliant on general food and retail in Sydney and Melbourne. So, yeah, that's the theory anyway.
And that's the point about scenarios, right? And a few comments I noticed in the chat about you know, is it worth doing scenarios, things change, etc. Well, of course things change, that's the whole point of scenarios, but at least it tries to give you some sensitivities to take account of the various things, right?
That's exactly right. Look, you know, of course I'm not a COVID expert, but where perhaps potentially our expertise can come in is that, okay, you tell me what's going to happen in the economy, you tell me what interest rates are going to do, how much government stimulus is going to be out there, then I can give you some sense in terms of what that may well mean for the housing market.
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
Think that's what it boils down to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. we're speaking off the same hymn sheet, I have to say, because that's what I try to do too. But, you know, there are lots of variables. And frankly, the international variables, of course, are also still there insofar that we don't know to what extent the virus will get under control in other countries around the world and how much of the international travel will reopen over what time frame. And those are big calls.
They are big calls. Noting now scenario three, we do believe that takes into account regional hub opening up.
Mm.
But it doesn't take into account ramping up of migration, a real ramping up of migration. If that comes along, I think that's a 2022 type of scenario.
Yeah, great. Okay, thank you. You might want to drop the scenarios off and appear in person. Person again. Great. Thank you for that. Now, there's a few questions I've been watching in the chat. I wouldn't mind getting some reactions from you. You mentioned regional locations doing reasonably well. What's your take on that? And do you think it's going to reverse simply because of the fact that the cities are beginning to, you know, perhaps open up a bit? Maybe people will stop thinking, well, I've got to go into the regional areas? Or do you think that regional migration process will continue?
I think property investors need to be very careful of the regions right now. Let's consider the regional Australia or regional townships, say townships of, say, you know, 30,000, 20,000, 10,000 people, maybe less, as being relatively illiquid towns, what I otherwise call shallow markets.
Mm.
They're the type of markets where they can shift very quickly, where all of a sudden you get a stampede of buyers and then the next month there's nobody there at all. They can be highly volatile. Now, from what we can see in the data, regional townships are in strong demand. There's no question about that. We know the reasons why. We first saw it in the rental market, and I think what happened was that very quickly a lot of the regional townships had to put out the no vacancy sign. But of course, people still wanted to move to these towns. So what did they start doing? They started buying into the towns. Now, that's all good, and potentially a lot of these towns offered really good value. And no doubt, many people have been attracted to their affordability. But we all know that they lack amenities in many respects, that a lot of these towns have got a lot to grow yet. And look, I think it's a good thing. It's a good thing long-term for our economy to be more diversified than our eight capital cities. You know, we do want to see the growth of regional towns, but we've got to be, investors and home buyers have got to be careful when this is done, how it's done, and just be watchful in terms of the fact that, look, hey, 1 month things can be really hot, the next month it can come to naught. And the problem is with these type of markets and regional towns is that when things do turn, like, it's not like as though the buyers are, say, 20% below where you are. There's no buyers at all. This is the issue. And we've seen this in mining towns. So when we had the mining downturn on the northwest shelf of Western Australia, like towns like Karratha, the median house price zoomed up in the boom, all the way up from about $300,000 all the way up to $1 million for a tin shed. And that fell all the way back down to $300,000 once more. Now, you can imagine being geared on the wrong side of that. And that's the risk. And that there is a significant risk here with regional townships. But nevertheless, I think there is going to be a certain component of the population who have actually used coronavirus as a catalyst for a move they always wanted to do.
Mm.
They always wanted to move to regional townships. And with the improvements in technology, being able to do Zoom like we are now, many people are able to work from home and they wanted that country lifestyle and they're getting it right now.
Well, I moved down to Illawarra, you know, nearly a decade ago now, and I've been running my business from here over technology. It's slowly got better and better. It's not perfect by any means, but it's still still pretty good. So you can do it these days. You know, the train is there if you really need to get into the city. So, you know, it's interesting. But no, I tend to agree. And I've been watching quite interestingly. I run one-to-one sessions where I talk with people about their thinking with regard to a particular area. And I've had quite a lot of questions about, you know, various regional places, you know, the sort of the coastal areas up towards Brisbane and just up over into the New South Wales border have been very hot there. A lot of people have been looking at that, thinking, oh, you know, maybe I can make a bit of money on the way up there. Well, maybe you can, but, you know, not necessarily forever, right? And that's really the point about some of these. The markets are quite shallow, as you say. And if the markets do change, maybe things will not continue so boldly and buoyantly as perhaps people are thinking at the moment.
This is true, Marvin. This is quite true. I'd only say that this has been a recent trend. Mm. There may still be some more to go in these regional townships. But the further it goes, the more risk you take. So I guess the main word here is just be cautious, be careful, do not overpay. There is still some value there to be had, but in other regions like around Byron Bay, I'd be very careful indeed.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's probably very, very good advice. Now, one of the other questions that came in a little while ago was the issue with regards to the high-rise sector. We touched on it a little bit, but people were asking for a bit more of perspective in terms of, you know, what's the story with the high-rise, particularly in those areas close into the centres of town, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane in particular. And you mentioned the high vacancy rates. I mentioned the investor issues. What's your sense there in terms of how that's going to play out?
Well, as alluded to before, we're starting to see a little bit of a trickle back of people moving back into the CBD location. So I am expecting Brisbane, Sydney, Adelaide, those CBDs to have a little bit of a recovery. But they're coming from very elevated positions, and I do not think it will be a complete reversal. Let's keep in mind that last year we completed about 170,000 dwellings, and the bulk of those were in inner city locations. So supply continued to increase for these areas over the course of 2020. So these are not areas that I'm expecting to be part of this current recovery we're seeing in housing prices. I think they're going to lag, they're going to underperform. Some buyers may well be enticed into these areas because they can get in, there's less competition, but they need to be very, very careful. I know the banks remain very cautious about these areas, and we provide data to the banks so they can see the data we can see. So the risks remain. It is, they call it a buyer's market, and it could increasingly become an even bigger buyer's market.
Absolutely. And the other thing I wanted to touch on, which is sort of moving out further, right? So the other thing I've been noticing a lot of is subdivisions. So if you look at in the inner suburban ring and beyond, there's a hell of a lot of people buying, you know, a house with a land, you know, 800 squares or whatever it is, and then basically knocking it down and putting three villas up on it, right? Subdivisions, and in fact, I've done a few shows where I've looked at particular areas, and the whole character of those areas are changing because of this higher level of concentration. They've changed the planning laws to allow basically higher density development, not necessarily high rise, but just higher density. So, you know, two, three or four stories or villas. That's changing the mix and also the price point and also the types of people living in those areas. How do you think that's playing out?
I would agree with that. Just hearing you discuss this, I'm really keen to bring up another chart, Martin.
Yeah, great, do.
Have we got time to do that?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, all right, okay, because I think it goes to this point. Maybe what I'll do, is there a particular postcode you had in mind when you're thinking about this subdivision that's been going on?
Well, I was looking specifically at some of the postcodes sort of south of the CBD, sort of down towards some Sutherland, though, some of those, you know, inner suburban areas.
Okay. Let's see if we can bring up 2232. Okay, I'll just do it before I share the screen. I'll just see if it comes up.
Yeah, that's right.
It does. Fantastic. All right.
Okay, you've got okay. control.
All right. Now, this might not come through very clearly, but I'm going to try my best to explain it. You'll see, you should see in front of you here, basically a curve, yeah. a pink line, which represents the whole Sutherland Shire and postcode 2232. The x-axis represents effectively square meters, and then basically the y represents the price per square meter.
Mm.
And we've got this mapped out for every postcode and locality. And a long time ago, I found a relationship between price and land size. And the relationship, as you might expect, is that the smaller the land size, the higher the price per square meter. This enables developers to go and develop. But the funny thing is that the relationship isn't linear. It isn't straight line.
Mm.
It's exponential.
Mm.
And so as showing in this chart here, if you buy, say, on average, an 800 square meter block, you can be prepared to pay somewhere around $2,000 a square meter.
Mm.
But if you were to actually divide that 800 square meter block to, say, 200 square meter, 100 square meter dwelling units, you could expect to receive somewhere around $7,000 a square meter. Mm. And so there is this constant incentive, and I sometimes do regard it as a bit of a risk-free profit, where you know the subdivision potential, the development potential, is pretty significant across many postcodes around Australia. Now, I don't know whether that answers your question or not, but there's a relationship there, and there is a large incentive to subdivide.
Yeah, absolutely. And that chart is a killer chart, right? Because I was showing somebody the other day something similar, because he was sitting on a quite a large plot with a house on it. And I was saying to him, well, you know, if you think about how you value it, you could value it as a single dwelling on that plot, and you might get this sort of value. But think about it like a developer. What would a developer do? A developer would think, I can get two or three or four, you know, villas on there, right? Now, what are those sort of prices going to be? What's the sort of the construction costs? And basically, it puts the value of that plot and property into a completely different ballpark.
100% it does. And it also explains why developers are willing to pay so-called crazy prices
yep.
to some vendors to get that last block in the lot, or that last lot in the block, shall I say.
Yep.
Because they're still going to make a pretty large profit in the scheme of things. Now, of course, keep in mind, developers will come back to that and say, well, hang on here, I've got to pay a lot of taxes. There's a lot of operating labor costs, and they have a reasonable point on that. We actually, going back all the way back to the fact we do ratings and managed funds, we come across a lot of developers who try and set up managed funds of property development. So we actually do get to see the return on equities that many developers achieve. And generally speaking, nowadays it runs for a project at about 15%, an IRR of 15%. And sometimes less. And that sounds like a lot, but it's also pretty thin when you're considering that many of these developers are geared right up. It's like flying a jet very close to the ocean surface.
Yeah, that's right. And you hope you don't get any waves that come up to meet it, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The profit can be huge, as we can see.
Yeah.
But the risks are pretty high too.
But the point I also wanted to make, Louis, was it changes the character of the suburb, right? And so you suddenly move from seeing, you know, a house on a, you know, 800 square block or whatever it is, to, you know, villas and low rise, medium rise. The character is completely different, and I think that's what people haven't fully understood. So again, I've been talking through my one-on-one sessions with people who were thinking of looking at an area quite close in, for example, close into Brisbane, you know, 8k from Brisbane, right? Mm-hmm. And I showed them the transformation that had gone on there, right? and it has moved from a very suburban, you know, quite relaxed area into a much more concentrated area, simply because of the planning changes and because of the economics that are being driven from the subdivisions. I think that people haven't got their head around some of this stuff, and the fact that a lot of the property market is actually being driven precisely by this particular lever.
Which goes all the way back to your population growth rates as well. So look, you know, yes, I agree with you that you know, that there is a relationship there. Is it right or wrong? Well, okay, I'm an analyst. I'm dominantly aimed at trying to tell what is and what might actually happen. People can see my opinions on Twitter pretty easily enough by my likes and dislikes. there's no doubt there's a relationship there. Population drives it. Of course, the level of interest rates drives it as well. There are levers we can push either way to control it or to open it up. And one of the things, of course, that happened in Sydney back in 2013 was that the local councils lost a lot of power in terms of approvals, and state planning laws really opened up developments in Sydney, particularly in Sydney's northwest. And that comes through our chart. You can see this period of oversupply, and still with us now in Sydney's northwest. And certainly, if you were someone that needed population growth to pick up, and you had a property, you had a development in Sydney's northwest, you'd be knocking on the state government's doors right now to get that lever going.
Right, and the last question for tonight, talking about levers, what about New South Wales proposals with regard to stamp duty? Do you think that's a big deal or a non-issue?
I think it's a pretty big deal overall. It's actually, when we say deal, it seems to be a pretty good deal for home buyers overall. So I've done the numbers there, and just to recall you, if you're a home buyer or an investor, you have a choice now. You can either pay the stamp duty up front, or you can decide to pay a land tax for each and every year. And I've got to say that doing the numbers have worked out that it's better actually to give away, not pay the stamp duty as a home buyer and pay the land tax. I think that's not a bad thing. I think that will actually improve liquidity in the marketplace. I think the break-even point, if I recall, was like 22 years. So if you hold the property for, say, 20 years, you're still ahead by paying the land tax over and above the stamp duty, assuming that the land tax rates stay the same over that whole time, which, of course, who knows, right? As a property investor, the numbers don't work out as well. I think the break-even point was more along the lines of about 5 years. But nevertheless, I think it's a good thing. I've always taken the view that land tax is potentially a reforming tax that potentially could help affordability and help liquidity in the marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is interesting that talking to a few people, the prospect of not having to find that extra lump sum to transact now, but to be able to spread it out over years is quite attractive because, of course, a lot of people are quite highly geared and having to reach out to try and be able to buy. So it does seem to be knocking over one of the barriers potentially to stop people transacting.
Quite true.
Well, Louis, I'm afraid we're running out of time. It's amazing how quickly we cover an hour plus and hour and a half. I really appreciate your insights. It's been a really interesting set of conversations. I just want to site up just to say there's a lot of information on your website at SQM Research. Do recommend that people go look. It is by far one of the most useful sites relating to property and other things around. One of the sites that I do spend a certain amount of time looking at as well in terms of the stuff that I do. So that's thoroughly recommended. And people can actually log in and sign up and do things, right?
Oh, absolutely. We've got free data, as you've highlighted. We've also got paid reports. One of our biggest sellers out there is actually our distressed properties report.
Mm.
So that's a login where you get access to properties which are selling via mortgagee in possession or divorcee sales. I think Neil Gemma once told me that was the ghouls report.
Yes.
I've both got that eventually. Right now it's got about 12,000 distressed listings, which has actually come down, which is a very interesting thing about 2020 is the fact that distressed listings actually fell away. And I think that's because of the banks providing the moratorium. But I won't start that conversation up now. That's for another time.
Well, I appreciate that, Louis. And, thank you very much for spending your time with us tonight and sharing your insights. It is appreciated. A lot of people have said they've enjoyed it and learned something, which is great. We'll keep chatting. You and I have some very interesting and similar perspectives in many ways, I think, about what's going on. And I sometimes think that we tend to zig while some of the other guys are zagging, and hopefully we're more right than they.
Oh, well, the future will tell.
Indeed. Thank you once again, and I really appreciate your time, Louis. I'm just going to take you offline now, and then I'll just close the show. So thank you very much. Have a great evening.
Thank you.
So there you are, folks. Good chat with Louis tonight. I think there's some really interesting insights there, and I do recommend going and have a look at his site. There's a lot of really powerful information there. Just in terms of closing out the show tonight, to say that next week, Tony LeCantre will be on, and he'll be talking about some of the latest market signals, bond rates and some of the other stuff that's going on. That'll be really, really interesting. So mark your diary there for the 16th of March. And think that that's pretty much all I'm going to do tonight. So I just want to say thank you very much for spending time with us on the show tonight. Thanks for all the comments. Thanks for all of those who contributed via Super Chat. And take care. We'll see you next week. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off.